A very warm welcome to St Paul's Cathedral for the next in our lecture series. My name is Paula Gooder and I'm Canon Chancellor here at St Paul's, which means that I look after theology and learning that takes place within the cathedral. Now let me introduce our speaker, who probably doesn't need very much introduction. Kate is one of those people who is known as that vicar off the telly, and many of us will know her from programs like Gogglebox, Celebrity Mastermind, Celebrity Master Chef, Pilgrimage, and of course, importantly, Songs of Praise.
Woohoo!
And if you are a Radio 2 listener, you will know her from her Good Morning Sunday programs. Before Kate became known as that vicar off the telly, she was a parish priest and a chaplain. And in many ways, I think those of us who know her would say that she is now a national chaplain in all sorts of different ways. Kate, as I've said already, is a very well-known person, but I am very honoured also to count her as a friend. So it is doubly delightful for me this evening to be able to welcome Kate to talk to us about her most recent book, Have a Little Faith.
Thank you so much, Paula. Thank you. Mind that. I spilt a load of water. Thank you so much. I had a little explosion with some water just there, so do be careful, don't slip. That vicar off the telly who isn't Richard Coles. That's the one who it is. It's really funny, actually, because sometimes what happens is I'll get a phone call asking me to go on to Radio 4 and comment on a Marla documentary or something, and I'll sort of phone Richard and go, I think they wanted you, really, but you probably weren't available. And sometimes he gets asked to go on Loose Women and talk about the menopause, so they've obviously got us confused. What's the sign for menopause? What's the sign for menopause? Oh, great. Good. Good to know. So I'm the Reverend Kate Botley. I never meant... Oh, just a minute. I'm having a photo taken. Just a sec. Action shot. Got it? Brilliant. The trick is to put your tongue in the roof of your mouth. Is the trick, because it brings your chins up. You're all doing it now, aren't you? I can tell you're all going like this. It's like saying the phrase pelvic floor at a Mother's Union meeting. Everyone all of a sudden starts doing it all together. I never meant to be a vicar. It wasn't what was on my agenda at all. You don't go and see your careers advisor at secondary school and sit down and say, I think I want to be ordained. That's not quite how it works. And I'm always very suspicious of anyone who says that they want to be a vicar when they grow up. It's a little bit like being a politician. If you want to do it, you're probably not the best person for the job. That's how that works. So I grew up in a solidly working class family in Sheffield. Was that a cheer for Sheffield over there? Excellent. Woo, woo. I grew up in a solidly working class family in Sheffield. I am first generation full female literacy in my family. My mum only learnt to read and write towards the end of her life, and my grandmother couldn't read and write at all. All of them left school at 13 or 14. And in those days, what happened was the school opened their doors and the factories opened their doors, and one went from one to the other. So it's a great shock and surprise to me that I had enough words in me to write a whole book. It wasn't quite what I was expecting. I wasn't brought up in a religious family at all, really. We were christened as babies, me and my brother, but we never, ever went to church. We didn't even go at Christmas or Easter or anything like that. We were christened as babies because you get the babby done, was what would happen. Get that babby done. And we were taken along, christened as babies, and my grandma would not allow my mum back in the house until she'd been churched. So my mum had to be churched before she was allowed back in the house. She had to go to church, and she had to had the baby christened, and then she would be allowed back in my grandmother's house. So there was very much a like folk religion thing around my family. So we weren't particularly religious, but we would always light a candle if we did go into a church, that sort of thing. And I think coming from a not really religious background has stood me in really good stead, being a parish priest. It means that sometimes I don't understand all the nuances and all the in jokes and in sentences and old boys club and all that sort of stuff that goes on in the Church of England. I'm just not part of it. Did you know, by the way, that the number of buttons you have on your cassock says something about your theology and what you believe in? It's crazy, right? I just presumed when people said to me, which college did you go to? They wanted to know which college I went to. Apparently that's not the case. When someone asks which college you went to, they're trying to work out what theology you've got and where you sit on the line of belief and whether you're one of their sort of people or not. I just presumed they just wanted to know which college I went to, but that's me. About age 14, 15, I was at secondary school, and we were in sets for things like maths and English and so on. And I was put in a set all on my own without my friends that I'd come up from primary school with. So I'm in this set in school, in my secondary school, and I'm trying to make friends, is what I'm trying to do. And there was a lovely girl there called Katie. And Katie went to church. She was one of the nice girls. She went to church, she'd always got clean fingernails, always really well turned out, Marks and Spencers. She looked lovely. And I started hanging out with Katie and some of her friends, and we would sit and have our sandwiches together in the quad at school. Now, quad makes my school sound posher than it was. It was just a patch of grass where we had our sandwiches. So I would sit on the quad with Katie eating my sandwiches, and one day this boy crossed the quad. And I said to my friend, Katie, who's he? And she said, he's the vicar's son. And I thought, I'm going to start going to church, I think. I only went for a snog and I came away with a dog collar. It wasn't really what I had in mind. It was a classic flirt to convert situation, as they say. We've been married for 26 years this May, so it all worked out rather well. I love it when you get a clap for how long you've been married for. I think that's all the married people clapping, going, oh, well done, well done. Some mornings you have to choose to love each other, eh? That's how that works. Graham and I got together, and I remember very clearly a moment that I went from not believing in God to believing in God. I remember it really clearly. Now, for lots of people, their journey into faith is a gradual thing. You know, perhaps they were taken to church and they sort of make get to a point where they kind of make a decision for themselves. But for me, it was an absolute moment when what happened was somebody, I'd started going to church and I'd started going to the Christian Union at school, and somebody said to me in school, so then, do you believe in God or what? And I went, oh, yeah, I do. And it was in that moment that I came to a realization of believing. Now, it was always like faith was a coat in my wardrobe that I didn't really wear very often. That's what it felt like. And so I talk about it felt like I stepped into my faith, like it was something that was always sort of there in the background, but I'd never really tried it on and worn it out. Does that make sense? So when people say to me, when did you become a Christian? Well, I sort of always was, really. It was just I'd not stepped into my faith. And I think for lots of people, faith is just something that's sort of there in the background, but not something that you perhaps wear out very often. Does that make sense? So I went off to train to be an RE teacher, much to the horror of my mum and dad. Because my mum and dad started going around the family and saying, "Yeah, Katie's got religion." Like it might be the worst thing ever, right? I remember my mum pulling me to one side because she thought I'd joined a cult. And I had to reassure her that it was just the Church of England and it was probably going to be all right. Telling my family that I'd found faith was a really hard conversation because they were very worried that I was going to go and become a nun or something. Of course, I ended up being a priest, so, you know, it kind of went the way they thought, really. But yeah, it was a really big shock because our family are not particularly religious. I come from a big working class Yorkshire family. If I tell you that I am known as the quiet one in my family, that should give you some idea of what they're all like. I have lots of aunties, my Auntie Mary, my Auntie Shirley, my Auntie June, my Auntie Anne. Some of them are my real aunties, and some are just people that my mum knows from Tupperware parties that we call Auntie. You might have aunties like that. My mum and dad met on the Parson Cross estate in Sheffield, very working class estate. And my dad tells a wonderful story of when he first met my mum, that he went calling in his suit with his DA at the back, you know, with his teddy boy suit on and his DA. If you don't know what a DA is, look at somebody who's nodding at me. His haircut at the back. And he went calling on my mum. And he knocked on the door. My mum's one of seven. And so he went, so they're all at the window looking out like that. Two-bedroomed house, seven kids, all at the window like that. And he went calling on my mum, and he remembers it clearly because he knocked on the door and he stood there waiting for her, and he heard this voice behind him going, "I won't be a minute." And he turned round and she was on the outside loo with the door open and her knickers round her ankles. And he says, "That's the moment I knew she was the woman for me." So they met and fell in love, and my mum was one of seven, my dad was one of three, very working class family on the Parson Cross estate. And Graham and I met and fell in love, and I went away to train to be a teacher. In 1993, I started at Trinity and All Saints College in Leeds, a Roman Catholic college. I didn't know it was Roman Catholic till I got there. Like I said, I'm not from a religious family, so I had no idea about all these different denominations and nuances. I just went there because I liked the course. And when I got there on the first day, and there was a big crucifix in every classroom, I thought, what's going on here then? So I went along to Mass. So I'd been going to an evangelical church, Graham's dad's church, where he was vicar. That's where I carried on going to church until I went to university. And I went from a charismatic evangelical church to a Roman Catholic Mass, right? So and this has been a theme throughout my ministry. I don't mind whether I'm crossing myself or putting my hand in air. I'm not really bothered. If I think God's in it, I'm happy. So I started going to Mass instead because it's not far to walk, you see, because the college was on site. So I just went there. And that's been one of the great gifts of my life, has been that I don't really mind what sort of version of the club I go to. I don't really mind. I'll sort of turn me on to anything, I guess. And I don't really understand all those kind of, you know, when people don't look for their own flavour. So when people say, "Oh, I don't like the worship at that church," I sort of get confused by that, because for me, you're not going to be entertained, you're going for something else that sort of transcends whether you like it or not. That's not necessarily what it's about. So I trained to be a secondary school teacher. I absolutely loved being a secondary school teacher. I taught RE, and I taught RE in Ecclesfield School in Sheffield. I taught at Ewland School in Sheffield, and I taught at Chaucer School in Sheffield. Rough, really rough, all right? State schools, RE. And I went to teach RE because my theory was everybody likes their PE and drama teacher. Nobody likes their RE teacher, do they? So I thought it was going to be really easy to be the best RE teacher anybody had ever had. I wasn't going to have to work very hard at, like, planning lessons. So I did things like, if we were doing baptism, if we were doing christenings, I would take a real baby in and christen the baby. And so we had a baby in all day that got christened about 12 times. It was called Barry in lesson one. It was called Tracy by the afternoon. We just kept dunking it, the poor thing. So we did stuff like that. We did food, we did dancing. I tried to connect the kids. A lot of the children would say to me, "Why do I have to do RE, miss? I'm not religious." To which I would always say, "Well, you're not a piece of wood, but you're doing design technology, so try not to worry about it." My classroom in one of the schools I taught overlooked the estate. And for those of you who are teachers in the room, you never forget their names, do you? Years and years later, you never forget their names. Ben Grocock was one of mine. That's his real name. Ben Grocock was called Ben Grocock, so he was already on a back foot. Do you know what I'm saying? Ben Grocock was one of my students, and his dad was the local drug dealer. And I loved Ben with all my heart, but he's having a rough ride of it. But my classroom overlooked the estate. So the window of my classroom overlooked the estate. And from where I was sat, you could see Ben Grocock's dad's house and people coming and going all day. And they'd come pop in for 5 minutes and then they'd go again. Anyway, one day I'm teaching. I remember it vividly. I was teaching the five pillars of Islam. And I was doing the lesson and I got 30 year nine lads, including Ben Grocock. Wasn't easy, as you can possibly imagine, to teach that lesson. So I'm teaching the lesson, and all of a sudden a shout goes up from the back of the classroom. Ben! Ben! Your dad's on roof! And sure enough, we look out of the window, and Ben's dad has climbed out of the bathroom roof and onto out of the bathroom window and onto the roof of the house. And the front garden is full of riot police who were doing a raid on Ben's dad's house. Ben's dad, God love him, spent the whole day sat on the roof. It's very difficult to teach when there's a drugs police raid going on outside your classroom. Very, very difficult to teach anything at all. Eventually, Ben's dad came down off the roof and he got carted off. And we saw him about 16 weeks later. So he'd obviously been inside for a little stint. And he came back and he was going to be he got community service. And the job they'd given him was the crossing patrol officer, the lollipop man outside school. He was the best lollipop man we'd ever had. Nobody was not stopping for him. Everybody was stopping. Everybody was stopping. Otherwise, they were going to get that lollipop through the back window and no drugs for the weekend. So everybody was going to do as they were told. Ben also, when we were having building work done at the school, one of the workmen left his keys in the JCB while he went for his sandwiches. And Ben decided that that was too good an opportunity to miss and decided to drive the JCB around the school car park for the rest of the day. So that was fun as well. Ben is now, his kids are at the same school now. So the generations are repeating themselves. And my friends who still work there assure me that history is indeed repeating itself. And should any of you want anything for the weekend, we can probably sort you out. Ben also once offered, I was trying to sell my car, I was trying to sell a Citroen Saxo at the time, and Ben said, well, just leave the keys in it, miss, we'll make sure it disappears. And he would offer to torch your car for the insurance for you. That was his little side hobby, only 20 quid, absolute bargain. I didn't take him up on it, just in case you worried. So RE teaching was an absolute joy and delight. I loved it. And I loved engaging people with stories that they didn't already know. Lots of these kids had no background at all in anything to do with faith, anything to do with church or anything like that. So I loved to tell them stories and to get them interested. They particularly loved the stories of the saints was what they really enjoyed. Lots of gore and blood and martyrdom always went down really well. So we did lots of that sort of stuff. Then I had my babies. I had Ruby, who's now 22, and I had lovely Arthur, who's 20. And when I was having the kids, I had a little break from being a teacher, from being in the classroom. And I had a lot of time on my hands. And if you haven't worked it out, I'm not very good at being bored. I'm not very good at that. It's my greatest fear. Snakes, heights, all that sort of stuff. I'm a celeb would be fine, but I couldn't handle the boredom would be what would get me. So I'm not very good at being bored. So I volunteered to be church warden at my local church. All right? I was the world's worst church warden. If you don't know what a church warden does, it's a lot of fire extinguishers, a lot of lead on top of roofs, a lot of locking and unlocking, a lot of chairs and tables and all that sort of stuff. A lot of detail things, not really my bag at all. What I actually really wanted to do was to do the job of helping with communion and helping hand the cup out and the bread out. That's what I really wanted to do. And being church warden meant that you could help with that. So that's what I really liked. I knew I wasn't cut out for church warden when one of the fire extinguisher people that come to check the fire extinguishers came to check the fire extinguishers. And we ended up going to the pub for lunch together and spending all day chatting. And he told me about his divorce, and he told me about all the awful things that were happening in his life. And at the end of the day, he left, having, I prayed for him and he left and he'd not checked the fire extinguishers. And it was at that point that my priest came up to me and went, I think it's not church warden, Kate. I think it's probably something else. He took me out for a curry, my vicar. Always be wary of a vicar that invites you out for a curry. And somewhere between the poppadoms and the chicken tikka masala, he popped the question. I thought he was going to ask me to have an affair with him. It was much worse than that. He said to me, I think you should think about being ordained. And I was like, oh no. And I remember having to go home and talk to Graham about it and say, I think I should be ordained. I think that's what's happening here. If you don't know what happens with the calling, when people say, sometimes say to me, what made you want to be a vicar? It doesn't work like that. What happens is you're called by the people that you serve. They say, oh no, we want you. We want you to step into this role. So I went to selection, as they called it back then. I went through the selection process, which I can only describe as the weirdest experience of my life, I think. So you get all these, you have all these interviews, you have all this discernment process, and at the end of it, they send you to something which is not unlike the X Factor judge's house. It's a country house in the middle of nowhere, because apparently the best way to work out whether you can talk to normal people is to put you in a house with other potential vicars and Christians. I think it would have been better to send us to a supermarket or a pub and see how we got on. But there we go. I'm not in charge of the vocations process in the Church of England yet. So, I remember vividly the moment I got the phone call from Bishop Cyril, it was. We used to call him Bishop Squirrel when he wasn't listening. Bishop Cyril phoned me to tell me that I'd got through the selection process and I could go away and train to be a vicar. And it was a wonderful moment of grounding from God, because you kind of get this lofty idea that you're going to wear a dog collar for a living and, you know, people are going to listen to you, you're going to be a respected member of your community. And I was in the toilets at the park with a toddler who was potty training, and another child. So a four-year-old and a two-year-old in the... And if you've ever been in toilets in public parks, they're not glamorous places, are they? So as Bishop Cyril phoned me, my phone going in my pocket, I tucked it under my ear, and I was sort of like, and hello, is that Kate? Because that's how bishops talk. Hello, is that Kate? And I said, yes, it is. Who's this? And he said, it's Bishop Cyril here. And I said, hello, Bishop. Yep. Yeah, just a minute. No, darling, don't touch it with your fingers. So it is a really grounding and glamorous moment. Deeply spiritual. And I like to think that sort of set the tone for kind of my ministry, really. So I went off to vicar school. I went to St. John's, Nottingham. It might not surprise you to know that I didn't fit in quite as I probably, everybody was lovely. People were very kind to me and absolutely delightful and joyous. But I was going to be locked away in lecture rooms with Christians for 2 years. It's not, no offense to the Christians in the house, it's not my idea of a good time, all right? So it was a really tricky place to be. So I did my master's and that was fine, did all that. And then they let me loose on parishes. And that's where the fun really started. So I did my curacy, and then I started, curacy is like an apprenticeship, and then I started in my own parish on my own for the first time. I looked after three churches, Blythe, Scrooby, and Ranskill. Aren't those the best names ever? And the best thing about being the vicar of Scrooby was that when you have a party, it's called a Scrooby do. Very good. Well done. See? You are listening, that's good. It's called a Scrooby-Doo, which was enormous fun. I was also a chaplain at an FE college, further education. So trainee plumbers, plasterers, builders, beauty therapists, those kind of very, exactly the same sort of learners that I've been looking after when I was a teacher. All right, so not necessarily academically gifted kids, but very vocational. And I loved it. Absolutely loved being chaplain at that college. It wasn't a faith college. It wasn't a religious college. It was just a normal kind of college for vocational students. I was basically the vicar that handed out condoms. That was my job, right? I spent 4 years going, is it burning or is it itching? No, I don't want to see it. that was my job. I took a lot of kids to the clinic. And I would get them knocking on my chaplaincy door and they go, excuse me, are you that vicar that hands out Johnnies? I don't know what the sign is for that. Are you that vicar that hands out Johnnies, they would say. And I'd go, yeah, that's me. And Carl would come in, he'd go, I'm going to Tenerife with lads. And I'd go, okay, how many do you need? Oh, 20 should do it. Only going for 7 days. So I did a lot of that, taking them to the clinic, helping them with their contraception, all that sort of stuff. I also, because it was a beauty therapy clinic, they need people to practice on, the beauty therapists, right? I was waxed to within an inch of my life. I would get stopped on corridors and people would go, is it grown back yet, miss? No, it's not grown back yet. You need to leave it another week. And it was wonderful. Those learners were so brilliant. They taught me so much about myself and about faith. Because they would, I remember once having my hair done, and it was when the women bishops debate was going on. And Keely was cutting my hair in the beauty salon. And she went, like they do, so you're going out tonight? She's doing my hair. You're going out tonight then? And I went, actually, I'm going to a debate about women bishops. And Keely said, ooh, what's a bishop? You know, and I think sometimes those of us who are faith expect people to understand this kind of language that we all speak. And because I'm not from that background, I have real empathy with people who wander into these places and go, I have no idea what's going off. At vicar school, they used to send us to the betting shop to put a bet on so that we would know what it feels like for people walking into church. Because you walk into a betting shop, I don't go to a betting shop very often, there's a language, there's a culture, there's a choreography, there's a way of doing things which you might not understand, and that's what it's like for lots of people walking into places of worship. There's something going off here and I don't know how to speak this language, I feel like a stranger. And I think sometimes for those of us who are part of an established faith group, we forget that this is really weird. It's really weird. We believe in a man raised from the dead, for goodness sake. It's a bit odd. Do you know what I'm saying? So we sometimes forget, and I think one of the gifts that I've got, and I'm really pleased to have, is that I'm not necessarily from that background. So I find it easier to step back and to have a look at the bigger picture. Brilliant being a chaplain, I absolutely loved it. And at the same time, I'm looking after 3 parish churches. Blythe is a massive, huge, priory, Gothic pile church. You know, it's huge. It was founded... back in the 1100s, so it's a really old church as well, and it seats about 400 people. There's only 150 in the village, so you're never filling it. You're never filling it, no matter how hard you try. But I did lots of things to try and get as many people to come and engage with the space as possible. And what happens to me is what I guess happens to a lot of people who are professionally religious like me. People come up to you and go, I'm not religious. And then they go, but. And then they proceed to tell me something that's a bit religious. So they go, I'm not religious, but I do like to light a candle if I'm in church. Or I'm not religious, but I do like to sing along with the hymns on Songs of Praise. I always wonder if those people go up to builders and go, I'm not a plasterer. You know, it's okay. I'm religious enough for lots of people. I can carry it. The other thing is that I often think when people go to church, you know, I'll say to people when I do funeral visits, might we see you in church? Oh, well, we're not really religious. What's that got to do with it? There's singing and free biscuits. Why won't you come? If you don't move on from that, then perhaps I'm not doing my job right, not you. You know, these buildings are often the best building in a community that sometimes only used for a few hours of the week by people who already belong to the club. Now, I don't want to offend anybody. I'm not really interested in those people. You're lovely. Thank you very much for your attendance. But it's the people who are not yet on that journey that I'm interested in. I think what we've done for a long time, certainly in my version of organized religion, is we've metaphorically and literally closed the doors to people. And what happens is people think to come through those doors, either literally or metaphorically, they've got to sign up to the whole thing. So it's a very strange idea that you would only come once you already believe. I think that's a really weird idea. If I was a French teacher and you were coming along to my French lessons, I wouldn't expect you to speak any French. If you're coming along to church, I don't necessarily expect you to know what on earth's going on or to engage with this in whatever level you want to engage with. And this idea that, oh, I don't go to church because I'm not religious, I find a really interesting one, and one that I kind of really want to challenge. Also, the doors have been locked, right? The doors have been locked. I remember when I started at Blythe, this huge, massive priory church, and there was a lovely lady called Maureen there, who was the verger. Maureen made me look tall. She was a tiny woman, but like all short women, and the speaker's one of them, we've got fire in our bellies, and you can't really stop us. And the first Sunday, we had a bride come to see us just before the service. And she said, I said, oh, welcome. We'd really like to get married here. And I said, yes. I always used to say yes. Yes, of course you can. And then figure out how we're going to make it happen. And the bride said, can I have confetti? And at exactly the same moment that I said yes, Maureen said no. So we looked at each other. And that same day, I went to open the doors of the church, and the church had two doors. It had these huge Norman doors, you know, floor to ceiling, massive doors, and then it had this little tiny door at the side that you couldn't get a pushchair or a wheelchair through. And so the first Sunday, I get my big key out, and I go to unlock the huge Norman doors, and Maureen goes, what are you doing? And I say, I'm opening the doors, Maureen. And she says, you only go through those doors when you're dead. And I said, not anymore, Maureen, not anymore. We're going to open these doors. Maureen had the good grace to resign a week later. God rest her. I was really grateful that she resigned, actually. She came to see me for a cup of tea at the vicarage, and she said to me, I don't think there's room for both of us. And she had the good grace, rather than argue with me every Sunday for the next 5 years or so, she said, I think I'll leave you to it. I'm going to be your biggest supporter, and I will cheer you on and shout for you, but I don't think you and me working this closely together is going to work. So I was eternally grateful. I am eternally grateful to Maureen for resigning. I was there when she died, actually. It was I didn't do it. It wasn't me. I got a phone call from her sons to say that she was in hospital and she wasn't expected to live. And would I come and sit with her? Of course, that's one of the great privileges of what I do. One of the chapters in the book that I'm most proud of is the chapter on death and dying, and thinking about that. And I encourage you not just to think about your funerals, but also to think about your death and how you might like that to be. You know, whether you'd like music playing, ideally where you'd like it to happen, all that sort of stuff. I've killed more people than I care to admit, to be honest with you. I have a knack of going into rooms and going, you can go if you want, and they just go, all right? So don't worry if I say it to you tonight when you're leaving. You can go if you want, we've finished. You'll probably all wake up tomorrow, so let's not worry too much about that. I went to see Maureen when she was in the last moments of her life, and it was a real privilege to be with her. I remember I was sat at the bed, and I was reading the Psalms to her, and I thought she was unconscious. But EastEnders was on, full blast in the corner, and I thought, I better turn that. It doesn't seem quite right, so I'll just turn it off. And I was reading the Psalms, and I turned off EastEnders, and she opened one eye and went, I was watching that. Put it back on. And what was wonderful, when I went to see Maureen, I went a few times to see her, and when I went to see Maureen, I got to the hospital, and as I walked into the hospital, there was a man in the foyer of the hospital, and he went, Kate! Like that, and I didn't recognise him. It happens to me a lot. Kate! Like that, and he went, she's here, she's here! And I thought, I don't know what this is, and he grabbed my hand, and he dragged me through the hospital, and I was trying to work out what was going on, and he dragged me into the maternity ward, and there was and it was a couple that had married a few years before, and there was their newborn baby daughter called Charlotte, absolutely gorgeous baby. Will you bless her? Will you bless her? Another one of those couples that were not really religious, but we'd like to get married in church. Will you bless her? Will you bless her? Because it's those kind of moments, isn't it? Births, deaths, marriages, those kind of big life moments when we scrabble about and try and find that scrap of faith that might be in there. And that, for me, that faith is as valid as, you know, as people who stand in that pulpit and talk. It's as valid as anything. You know, it's not about quantity. It's not about quantity. Somebody much wiser than me, with a beard and sandals, nice Jewish lad, loved his mother, said, faith of a mustard seed is what he talked about, and I think that's really true. So I was in this, I was in the maternity unit, and there was a bottle of Prosecco on the bedside table, so we popped that, and I did the business with the Prosecco. And then I went upstairs and anointed Maureen as well, and there was a great parallel in that. And I think we're all trying to navigate what this journey is about, right? We're all trying to find out what it's about. And I want to give permission. My aim through my ministry and through the book that I've written is to say, it's all right, you know. You don't need to be professionally religious. You don't need to believe all of it all the time right now. You know, I bury very little coffins sometimes. On days like that, it's very hard to have faith. It's a really difficult day to believe in things. But we find our faith, and sometimes it's the tiny scraps of what we believe. But it grows and it develops. And you don't need to have all the answers all the time straight away. How are we doing?
Doing good. 5 minutes.
5 minutes, great. So that's what the book's all about. And I had the great privilege recently of being in the room when my own mum died. And it is a privilege to be in those rooms. For those of you who've been in those spaces, it's a great privilege to be there. One of the last things that I got to do was I got to get the iPad working for my mum so she could watch Songs of Praise. And I put Songs of Praise on in the hospital room. And I said, oh, look, mum, it's one of my episodes. And she went, I prefer it when it's Allied. Like only a mother could. And I was able to be there when she went, and it was she had a really good death. A good death is entirely possible. My friend Jean had a really good death too. One of the great challenges of being a parish priest is every now and again you have to bury your friends, and that's always a tricky thing. Jean was a huge woman of faith. She had faith that I will never have. And we got on like a house on fire, even though we were very different. Politically very different, socially very different. She was a farmer. I'm from a steel city, you know, I'm from an industrial town. In fact, Jean, when I first moved in, used to leave pheasants on my doorstep as a little gift, because, you know, they'd shot them and stuff. And any other job, a dead animal on your doorstep is a death threat. In Vicarine, in rural Vicarine, it's a welcome to the neighbourhood. Jean was an amazing woman. She had a Formula One Silverstone, that's right, isn't it? Silverstone experience for her 80th birthday. So she was my kind of woman. She just liked to go fly fishing. And she was dying. She was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and she knew she was dying. She was in the hospice, and she invited me along. And she said, I'm really worried about you doing my funeral. So why is that, Jean? She said, well, we're friends, aren't we? So how are you going to do it? Are you going to be able to hold it together? Jean, I'm a professional. You underestimate me. I can do this. I'm going to be really professional. I will hold it together for your funeral. And I will be really professional when I meet with your family. And I will be really professional during the service. But when the day is over, I will walk up my drive to my vicarage and I will get a bottle of something fizzy and cold out of the fridge, a bottle of champagne out of the fridge, and I'll put a straw in that bottle. And I'll put my pyjamas on, and that's when I'll do my grieving. That's when I'll do my grieving. And just like you, she had a little chuckle. Anyway, she died and I was able to be there with her. It was a great honour. And I did hold it all together, you'll be pleased to know. I was very professional. Held it all together for Jean. And I was professional at the funeral, I was professional at the visit, I was professional at the wake, and then I knew at a moment that I needed to go home now and I needed to have a cry for my friend. And as I walked up the drive of the vicarage, I could see something on the doorstep. And when I got to the doorstep, there on the doorstep was a bottle of champagne and a straw. And a little note that said, if today has gone according to plan, today is the day of my funeral, and you'll need this. And Jean had arranged for that to be delivered to my house. There are three things no one will talk about at your funeral. How clean your skirting boards were, how big your blank bank balance was, and how big your bottom was. So try to not worry about any of those. Faith the size of a mustard seed. Some days it's big, some days it's small, But the most important thing is that nobody has all the answers to this. None of us have got it all sewn up, even those of us who are professionally religious. Sometimes the best we can hope for is that people might want to drink champagne at our funeral.
So a reminder to you that if you want to ask Kate a question and you're not a Twitter kind of person, write it on the back of your programme, wave your arm in the air, and our fabulous colleagues will come and collect it from you. Christine here is ready to collect it from you if you're ready to ask a question. But I get to ask you the first question.
What fun!
I'll ask you nice ones, honestly.
Thanks.
You mentioned the beardy man with the sandals.
Yes, he's a nice chap.
Generally goes with the name of Jesus.
Yes, that's him.
What does Jesus mean to you?
I think one of the real kind of key moments for me was sitting in that chapel at Trinity and All Saints, in the Roman Catholic chapel, and I'd not really seen crucifixes before. As I said, I've been a charismatic evangelical church, so the crosses didn't really have Jesus on. Bill Bryson tells a wonderful story about a girl going into a jewellery shop to buy a cross, and the person behind the counter goes, "Do you want a plain one or one with a little man on it?" I'd not really seen crosses with a little man on them before. And one of the things that really struck me about that is the crucifix in Trinity and All Saints Chapel is it's very graphic. It's quite hard to look at because it's Christ in his agonies. And I was struck by the humanity of Jesus in that. And for me, that's key to understanding who Jesus was. It's his humanity. You know, I don't know if you've been watching the Pilgrimage program recently, but Spencer Matthews is on that. Now, bearing in mind that Spencer Matthews, if you don't know who he is a reality TV personality person. He went to Eton, and on the pilgrimage, he finds out that Jesus was a real human person. He did not know that. Bearing in mind he went to Eton, right? He did not know that Jesus was an actual human being that lived, and there is evidence to prove that. Whether he was the Son of God, whether he is the Messiah, is up for debate, right? But the fact that he was a human being is true. You're nodding, aren't you? Good, because you're a clever one. So, the humanity of Jesus is really key to me understanding. And the working class narrative in that is really key and important to me as well. And the idea that, at Easter I was reflecting on that he was killed by the tools of his trade was one of the things that, because there's always new stuff to learn, right? That's what's amazing. So one of the things for me about Jesus is his working class nature as well. So the humanity and the working class stuff.
And have you ever thought about just jacking it all in?
Yeah.
Saying it's not worth the effort?
Yep. This morning, 10 minutes ago, in the vestry before I came out. Yes, all the time. I think there's somehow this presumption that if you are professionally religious, that you believe it all every single minute of every single day. That's an absolute fib. Doubt is really healthy, and questioning is really healthy. And I am prepared to be wrong. I'm prepared for this to all be wrong. But the good news is, if it is wrong, I won't know anything about it. So it's a win-win, right?
True.
It's a win-win, because I'll be dead and I won't be conscious, so it'll be fine. I question it all the time. And I think that's really important.
So I've got my first question coming, which relates just to what I've asked you. So how do you cope in times of disbelief, those moments where it just all feels impossible and you can't deal with it? What do you do then?
Sometimes I hide under a duvet and eat carbohydrates. That's always a good thing. But eventually you have to come out from under the duvet. And I find, and this is such an Anglican answer, but I find other people's words really helpful. When I can't believe, I usually turn to someone who is believing and use their words. So, for example, in the church we have something called liturgy, which is the words that are like the set words in the book for services. So, for example, if I've got to do, you know, I've done some, there's a story in the book about a baby that I buried who was murdered by its dad. And on days like that, you just have to rely on someone else's words because you've got no words. So when I go through something really tricky like that, and it's tricky for me, so it's, you know, imagine what it's like for the family, you rely on people that are cleverer and more believing than you. And that's what it means to be a community of faith, right? That's what it means to be a community of faith, is that if you can't believe it today, then perhaps somebody else can believe it for you. And for me, it's really important, that connectedness. So I think there's something about, this is in the book as well, there's something about being human is to be connected with yourself, connected with other humans, like we're doing now, and to be connected with something bigger than yourself. I call it God. Other people call it all sorts of different things. But that search for connection is what it's all about. And on bad days, lean into other people who can believe it for you.
So we've just touched on serious stuff.
That is quite serious. Have you got a question about how do they make goggle boxes? Is that what you've got?
No, next. No, I haven't.
Well, we can. Why did they move Songs of Praise from 4 o'clock?
I've got one from Lisa, who's a parish priest herself, and she's got 4 rural churches, and she's after some new material.
Okay.
I thought now would be a good opportunity to ask you. What's the best insult you've received as a priest that you've managed with humour?
Oh, I love this question. I've just got such a list. The way that I came to fame, let's use that word, was I did a flash mob at a wedding that went viral on YouTube. So what happened was I married a couple called Gary and Tracy. The music went, everybody dance now. I start dancing, they start dancing, the whole congregation started dancing. It got put on YouTube, it got 10 million hits on YouTube. So it was crazy. And that's where Gogglebox came from, that's where, you know, that's how it all started, really. When that was going viral, I'd not done much media before. So I was, and you remember, I'm a parish priest at this point, so my phone number's out there. People were just ringing the vicarage just to shout at me. You know, there was stuff coming through the door. I got a dog poo in the post. You know, all sorts of, like, because I'm a parish priest, so it's really easy to get hold of me. The best insult, though, was I was in a Tesco car park loading stuff into the car, and somebody shouted, Whore of Babylon! At me. Which I thought was amazing. Because that told me that they actually had a bit of theology, so I was quite impressed, really. So I got called a whore of Babylon in a Tesco car park, which really upset me. And the way that I handled it was I phoned Richard Coles, because he'd given me his number and said, you know, this wave's coming to hit you. If you need some support, phone me. So I dialed his number and I was sobbing. Richard, someone's just called me a whore of Babylon in a Tesco car park. And there was a pause on the line and he said, oh, darling, get to Waitrose immediately. So that's how I handle it.
I also have my top 10 insults.
Oh, I love this game. Let's play this game.
And then
the Christians are the worst, right?
Yeah. So then what happens is when somebody insults you, I distract myself by going, yeah, but should that be at number 4 or number 5 of my top 10? And then I forget to be cross about it, which is, I find, quite a useful technique.
My standard response is, thank you for your feedback, every blessing. That's my standard response. Thank you for your feedback. Yours with every blessing, the Reverend Canon Kate Botley. And then I put all the letters after my name that I've got, including some made-up ones.
So you've talked a bit about the church and being ordained. And do you think you've found your place in the church?
I almost, on a daily basis, want to leave it. But it's a bit like that uncle that you have to invite on Christmas Day that you don't 100% agree with, but you have to invite him, sort of thing, you know. It's a funny place, the church, but nothing ever changed by leaving, I don't think. But it does get close every now and again, particularly on the stuff about sexuality, particularly on the stuff about women, I find really tricky. But I consider what I do, and if you've not worked it out, I am an egotistical maniac and a desperate show-off, right? I love it. Okay, this is my idea of a really good day out. You know, this is great. One-on-one, no thank you. This, marvellous, love it. It fills me with joy and happiness to be in front of an audience. I love it so much. I consider this as much of a vocation as being a parish priest. It is a parish. It's just a really weird one. It's just a very unusual pulpit and a very weird parish. I still have all the same things. You know, on the train coming down, I still ended up talking to someone and praying with somebody. You know, and it will all be over. One, the media's really fickle. I shouldn't say this too loud because my agent's sat in the audience, but just put your fingers in your ears, Tracy and Anna, just a minute. It'll all be over one day. They'll stop. The phone will stop ringing one day, right? And I will have to go, well, that was fun, right? I just hope that whatever's next feels as much a part of my calling and vocation as this does right now. I am having an absolute blast. It's so much fun. And I loved being a parish priest, and I loved being a teacher, and I loved being a chaplain, and I loved being that vicar off the telly. It's great. And yeah, I just hope that whatever my vocation takes me next is just as Kate-shaped. Because that's the thing, I remember the night before I got ordained, I remember thinking, this is it, it's done. Because everybody had told me all the way through the discernment process, not everybody, but some people had told me through the discernment process and through college, oh, you won't be allowed to do that when you're a vicar. You won't be allowed to say that when you're a vicar. You won't be allowed to wear that when you're a vicar. You won't be allowed to go there when you're a vicar. All these things I wasn't going to be allowed to do. And so I thought being ordained was about disappearing. In fact, that's one of the things someone told me about robes, about cassocks and chasubles and all that sort of stuff that we wear up the front, is that the reason we wear that is so that we disappear and the congregation can concentrate on the host, on the communion service. And I was like, okay. And I remember praying the night before I got ordained, all right, if that's what you want, if you want me to disappear, if you want me to be less, not be Kate, and just be this kind of blank canvas thing and be very vicarly, then I'll do that. That's fine, because I wanted to be obedient. People think I'm a bit of a rebel and a maverick. I am really a rule keeper. I think it's a bit of an indictment that people come up to me sometimes, Paula, and they'll go, oh, you're a breath of fresh air for the Church of England. I'm a straight, white, university-educated, able-bodied woman. In any other job, I would not be a breath of fresh air for anybody. But in the Church of England, somehow I am. I remember the night before I was ordained thinking, this is it. You stop being Kate now and you become the Reverend Botley. And it was exactly the opposite. God went, oh, no, we don't want less. We'll have some more, please. Oh, you're a show-off, are you? Here's a microphone. Off you go. It was, and it's brilliant.
I'm very glad that you have found your place. And I think I'm probably not the only person here. I have a company that Kate's found her place where she is. You're looking at my questions.
Sorry,
my questions.
Can't help it. The other thing that happened the night before I was ordained, this is a bit of a naughty story, and I've got to be careful because my sister-in-law's in. She might tell me, I know, she'll keep her confidence, I'm sure, as will you all. The night before I was ordained as well, I remember Graham getting a bit upset. I mean, not too upset, but a bit upset. He went, I feel like I'm losing you a bit. Because tomorrow you stop being Mrs. Botley, you start being the Reverend Botley. And I'd not thought about that. Now, he's not some sort of, you know, misogynistic, that's my woman kind of bloke, not in any stretch of the imagination. But there was this sense of him like, oh, is it going to change? Because also, you know, I'm going to be his vicar. What's it going to be like snogging his vicar? What's that going to feel like? It's going to be like sleeping with your parish priest, you know. He was feeling a bit weird about the whole thing. So when I was ordained, you get ordained and then you go up and you share the peace after you're ordained with your friends and family. And I sort of went up to him and I whispered in his ears and I went, I've got stocking and suspenders on under this. And he went, oh, that's my girl.
Let's go somewhere completely
different. Okay, let's go somewhere completely different before I tell rude stories.
Having been brought up a nominal Christian family, what do you think of the term cultural Christian?
I love cultural Christians. I mean, unsurprisingly, I think it's great. You know, I love the people that do the I'm not religious, but I think we dismiss folk religion at our disservice, really. I think there's this idea that people come to church, don't they, with their, or they approach religious people with what they've got. So I remember a girl coming to get married once, and she said to me, can I get married in church? And she presumed the answer would be no. So she went, can I get married in church? And before I could say yes, she went, I went to Brownies. Like, that's what she got. right? And I just think, what disservice have we done as the national church, where as the national church, that is the church of England, not just the church of the people that come to it, you know, what a disservice have we done that someone would come and go, I've been to Brownies, like, you know, that's all I've got. This will this get me in? You know, I just think that just breaks my heart. And, you know, I used to be, when I was first found faith, I was quite fervent and very full on, and I've mellowed a lot. And so, you know, I used to be quite dismissive of my mum's superstitions, and, you know, that she would light a candle in church, and I'd think, oh, well, that doesn't mean anything because she doesn't actually believe it. But, you know, there was a moment when my mum was really ill. She was in intensive care a few years ago, actually, and she wasn't expected to survive. And I took all my Yorkshire aunties, you know, down to the chapel in the hospital. Bearing in mind, this is not a religious family. We all went to the chapel. I said, oh, I'm going to go and pray. And I was quite pious in those days. I went, I'm going to pray, sort of thing. And we all went down to the hospital chapel. And I thought, oh, I'm the Christian here. I'm the Christian. I've got the words. I'll do the praying, right? And we sat round in a circle, all my aunties, my auntie Mary, my auntie Shirley, and all these people. And I wanted to pray for my mum. Now, I knew that I couldn't pray for her to get better, because if she didn't get better, then what would that look like to these non-Christians that God hadn't healed her? So I couldn't pray. So if I prayed, please make my mum better, and she didn't, then they wouldn't become Christians, you see. But I can't pray for my mum to not get better either. So what am I going to do? So I did an Anglican fudge, as a good Anglican fudge, like you do. So the prayer I prayed was, Dear Lord, if it is your will, heal Margaret either in this world or the next. You see, he covered the bases. I said amen. All my aunties said amen. All my non-Christian aunties said amen. And my auntie Mary went, I'm not being funny, are Katie? But what the bleeding hell were that? So what do you mean, Auntie Mary? She said, I'll pray. So I thought, oh, crikey, Jesus, you're in for it now. So we closed our eyes again, and my Auntie Mary went, Jesus, when thou were on earth, thou did miracles. We need one, you do one. We are not the gatekeepers of faith. We're just not. You know, grace is not a finite resource that is for the religious to distribute or withhold as they see fit. That's why if you come up to your rail and hold your hand out, I will give you some bread. You know, and a number of christenings I've done where they come up to the rail and they go like that, and they go, and I go, body of Christ, and they go, thank you, like that, because they don't know the words. And then I'm clearing up at the end and they've all took the wafers under the seats, and I have to go around going like, all off. Because, you know, we're not the custodians of grace. It is not a finite resource. There's more than enough of it to go around.
There's a cracking one here. If you think that you might believe in God, but have never done anything about it, what would you say to that person?
Oh, that's a great question. It's interesting, isn't it, when we talk about believing in God? Because when someone tells me they don't believe in God, and then they tell me about the God they don't believe in, I don't believe in that God either. I wrote an article for The Guardian, not the workshop Guardian, the actual Guardian. A little while back.
Impressive.
And, thanks, Bebs. All about gender pronouns for God. And I talked about how it didn't make sense to call God he, and it didn't make sense to call God she, and that God was God, you know, completely unique, like nothing else, and that any pronoun we do use is inadequate. Any description we use of God is inadequate, but we're limited by language, and so we have to use inadequate language. So it makes no sense to call God anything, really. And I also said as part of this article that I did not believe God was an old man on a cloud in the sky that controlled the weather. Now, I thought, nobody thought I believed that. But apparently not. There were letters galore that I'd said that I didn't think God was a white man on a cloud with a beard that somehow controlled the weather. I don't believe that's what God is. The story I always tell is... I once tried to explain this to someone in terms, I mean, in great theological terms of I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. So when you're an I'm a celebrity, get me out of here, they eat like kangaroos, unmentionables, don't they? The people that don't have a television in the room are very confused right now. And when they say to them, what does it take? When Ant and Dec go, oh, what does it, I can't do a Geordie accent, so I'm not going to. What does it taste like? The celebrity will say, it tastes like chicken, right? I'm here to tell you that kangaroos unmentionables don't taste like chicken. They taste like kangaroos unmentionables. But because you don't know what those taste like, I have to use language about something that you do know what it tastes like. And that's what we're doing when we're talking about God. We use language that we can relate to and understand because we can't relate to what God actually is. So what would I say? Try not to worry about it too much. Try not to worry about it too much.
And just see what happens.
See what happens. Yep. Don't force it. It'll come or it might not. And it'll be okay. I think, you know, someone once sent me an email that said, when were you so sure that God existed? When was the moment you were so sure that God existed? And I wrote back, any day now, hopefully.
But since you've raised that, let me ask you a question off the back of it. Have you ever had one of those moments, you know, where you are just kind of overwhelmed by knowing?
Yeah, so many moments. I mean, the classics are when your baby's born, you know, all those kind of moments, those sorts of bits. But there was a moment in the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. I was filming a documentary for the BBC, so I was at work, and it was proper chaotic. I don't know if you've ever been to the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. It's the church where Jesus' cross was, where he was crucified, but also where his tomb was, allegedly. It's one of the holiest places in the whole of Christianity. And it's also a place where there's lots of arguments between all the different sections. Like the Greek Orthodox have it on a Monday, and the Ethiopian church have it on a Tuesday, and they all argue. And they have to have a Muslim look after the key because they can't agree who's going to be the key holder. There's a ladder outside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre that nobody knows why that ladder's there. Somebody put a ladder up one day to do some repairs like 300 years ago, and then someone tried to take it down and it caused a riot because that ladder's always... And it's that kind of... So the ladder stays because it will cause a civil war within the church if they take it down. It's a place of great division. We got there, and fortunately, it was the Greek Orthodox day. Now, I've been to theological college. I can do a bit of Greek. I can do a bit of New Testament Greek, and I can do a bit of, like, you know, Greek as well. I can order two beers and an Eros and some lasagna. No, it'd be moussaka, wouldn't it? I can do a bit of Greek.
You might be able to have lasagna if you...
Yep, so yassas, papas, you know, yassas, tikanes, all that sort of stuff. And they locked me in the place where Jesus's body was supposed to have been laid. It's a little chapel in the middle of the Holy Sepulchre, and the crew were setting up. And I wandered in to this tiny little space where there's a stone sort of plinth where Jesus' body is alleged to have been laid. I don't know if it's the real place or not. It doesn't really matter, because that's the place where people have been for centuries, have been through this space. And they locked me in. They locked me in. And I had 10 minutes in there on my own. And I have never met God in such a crazy way. It was just blew my mind. I cannot articulate what happened in there. I still don't really get it, but something definitely did. And then the other big moment that stands out for me is on ordination retreat. They send you away for 3 days of silence. So you can imagine how well that went, can't you? I watched a lot of, it was in the days of DVDs, and I got an Amazon delivery to the retreat house because I hadn't got through all my DVDs, and I was just watching telly. But people holier than me were doing praying and being holy, and I just could not engage with it. Now, brilliant thing about God is God knows me really well. So I went, right, you've got 10 minutes. I said to God, you've got 10 minutes, what do you want to tell me? And I went up onto a hillside and I sat amongst some sheep, and we had a lovely 10 minutes together. And I got through that 10 minutes what might have taken someone else with a different spirituality 3 or 4 days to get to. I'm not saying I'm better, I'm just saying I'm different, all right? It's not one size fits all. And I always say to the people who like silent retreats and quiet days, when are we having a noise day? When are we having an extrovert's version of this? So it's not, that's the other thing about faith. I genuinely think it's not a one size fits all. I suffered a lot from feeling not holy enough a lot of the time in the church, that I'm not quite holy enough, and that I'm not clever enough, or that I'm not spiritual enough. I remember one bishop once said to me, "On paper, Kate, you appear very spiritually deep. However, on meeting you..." It's not a one-size-fits-all. I don't want to do theology for, you know, I'm not interested in lecturing, or I'm not interested in being a bishop or any of that stuff. I'm interested in doing theology for Bella magazine and Take a Break and Loose Women and all those things. And people are a bit, the other thing you need to know is people are a bit snobby and sniffy sometimes, I'm afraid. And that's okay, but that's what I'm interested in.
So we've got a bit serious again.
So I'm so sorry.
No, no, you are allowed. Serious is allowed, but...
We're in quite a serious place, Paul. I mean, right. I know you work here, but it's quite a serious place.
Now let's go in a different direction. Right. Who would you like to play you in a film about you?
Great question. Do you know Jessica Stevenson, who was in Spaced? Yeah, Jessica Stevenson, please. I mean, that's who I'd like to play me. Thank you. Or what's her name who does Alma? Sophie Winans. Do you know Sophie Winans?
Oh, yeah. No,
I think she'd be really good as well. You might not know those people, but do Google them. They're lovely.
How do you balance being a faith leader in the public eye, and having a public profile with actually your Christian faith? You know, how do you balance those two? Because I imagine that some people would think that it's really hard to be kind of this big public Christian and keeping your faith alive.
No, my faith's better now than it's ever been, I think. It has its moments, of course, but I get to pray for Kylie, which is really cool. You know, I get to hang out in really cool places with really people that need, you know, nobody's... I remember once coming home from the Radio 2 show that I do, and I went straight to church, and I had my BBC lanyard still around my neck, and I'd just come off doing 3 hours of live radio from BBC Radio 2, and I went into church, and the person doing the intercessions, the prayers at the front, was praying against the evils of celebrity and the media culture. Felt a bit got at. Everybody is loved. Everybody is loved by God, and everybody needs praying for. We rightly so pray for doctors and nurses and teachers and all that. Nobody's praying for Michael Bublé from the front of church. I get to do that. And I get to be a Christian presence, a faith presence, not just Christian, but a faith presence in that space. And I really enjoy it. And the conversations we have, I'm not there to change anybody's mind. Do I think me being on the wheel is going to make somebody fall on their knees in front of Saturday night TV and go, "I give my life to Christ"? No, of course not. Don't be ridiculous. Do I think they might think, "Oh, she seems all right"? That's it. That's all it is. Just warmth. Just warmth, and that we're not all bigoted, nasty people who lock doors, and that there might be something in this, that you don't necessarily have to believe all of it all the time, but that faith might still have something to say in your life. It might still be something that you can get benefit from and that can help you live a better and richer life, really.
So someone's reading your book with their 10-year-old son.
Okay. And don't think there's any rude words in it.
No,
might be one.
They're having brilliant discussions as it goes along. And they want to know what you would say to children about trying out faith.
I think I'd just listen to what they've got to say to me. They've usually got all the ideas. One of the mad things about doing funerals is quite often the grown-ups don't know what to say to the kids. And the kids are brilliant at this. They're so great at it. So often the grown-ups will go, I'll go and do the visit, and they'll say, "We've told him that Granny's a star in the sky." And I'll go, "And do you think Granny's a star in the sky?" "No." "Well, then why have you told him that?" "Well, we didn't know what to say." "Well, then don't say anything. Just say, you know, this is what some people think. This is what other people think. What do you think?" You know, we can trust children to figure this stuff out, can't we? We can trust them. And often they're more accepting and more open to the conversation. We get all embarrassed as grown-ups because we're not supposed to talk about politics and religion, are we? We're not supposed to talk about those things. I can kill a room by walking in and suddenly. When you get vicars together, we all chat death. That's what we do. Within 30 seconds, we're all going, have you been busy this week? It's like taxi drivers. You've been busy this week, what you got on? Oh, I did a 78-year-old last week. You know, that's what we do. That's how we do it. So I think you can trust children with that conversation. And don't think that as a grown-up you have to have all the answers. Just go, I don't know, what do you think? What happens when you die, Mum? I don't know, what do you think? Some people think this, some people think that. What do you think?
Someone's asking, what would you advise someone considering going into ordained ministry?
Don't.
Any advance on
that? No. There is a thing, isn't there, about you should be reluctant. I remember once going to an ordination of bishops, a consecration of bishops, isn't it? They all gather around them, like, you know, like farmers in his den. We all pat the bone. They all gather around them. And the person next to me said, this is the exact moment they remove his spine. Like that, because he becomes spineless once you become a bishop. What would I advise? Pray a lot. Ask a lot of questions. Don't believe everything you're told. But that goes as good life advice anyway, I think. Pray a lot. Ask a lot of questions. Don't believe everything you're told. And hold on to who you are. Get a really good team around you who are going to advise you and be honest with you. And try not to give up. If you really think this is your vocation, then keep going until someone... I just said to myself, I remember when my vicar said, you know, you remember between the poppadoms and the chicken tikka masala, said, I think you should get ordained. I remember thinking, I'll just see how far I can get. Somebody will say no at some point. I'm still waiting for the phone call. Someone will say no at some point. It's a shock. It's a real shock being ordained. There's a moment for me every time I do communion, and I'm like a supply vicar now, so I don't have my own parish. I sort of just pop up when people are off or ill. Sometimes they don't know I'm coming, which is a lot of fun. They don't know it's going to be me. And so they sit there and you can see people trying to work it out, thinking, I know her from somewhere. Where do I know her from? Happens on train as well. And there's a moment when I do communion, and it happens to me every single time, that I hold up the host and I do the prayer of consecration, and then I hold up the chalice. And chalices are big, shiny, silver things mostly, which are like a mirror. And so there's a moment when I hold it up and I go, oh, I'm a priest. And it gets me every single time. It still shocks me. It still shocks me that I wear one of these around my neck, which is a Tresemme bottle, by the way, this one. You know, I was on a Songs of Praise shoot and I'd forgotten my piece of plastic. And so I had to go to Boots and buy a conditioner bottle and wash it out and cut it up with my Swiss Army knife. And that's what this one is.
I spent quite a long time actually in the beauty aisle once with a
yeah.
We'd forgotten the collar.
Yeah.
We were trying to decide what would be the most outrageous bottle to buy to return it to their
collar. VO5. Help split ends.
One of those really nice pink ones.
Yeah, brilliant.
So how do you maintain joy when faith is hard?
I really like to go out dancing. I like dancing. I like having a good time. I'm serious about having a good time. I like parties. I like hanging out with friends. I think that's probably more to do with happiness. I try and do a happiness audit every now and again. So I guess it's old-fashioned counting your blessings, really. There's a lot to be joyful about. I'm really loved, and I believe I'm loved by the very author of love itself, by the very inventor of love. And that is mind-blowing to me, that I am loved by the thing that brought love into being. So that kind of keeps it. But it doesn't mean they don't get me. You know, I have some awful stuff, as you know, like you do here. You have awful stuff, you know, especially as women in public ministry, we get all sorts of stuff chucked at us. Women generally, you know, any woman you see in the public eye has had, you know, unwanted sexual contact sent to them, has had hate mail sent to them, and it's particularly women. So, you know, some of the blows are really big blows, you know, and you try and remember that people don't know you. And that you loved, and loved. And I'm a work in progress, and that I haven't got all the answers, and that I'm just as broken and fallible and messed up as anybody else. But that's good, because they're messed up too. So there's a real equity in it, isn't there? That we're all loved and messed up. Brilliant.
Oh, someone's been saving a corker for the end.
I said,
what's your opinion of sin?
Oh my goodness.
Does God punish people? We've been having a nice chat, so now we'll do a bit of hard theology. What do you think?
Okay, I was on This Morning the other week. And I love doing daytime telly, because I love daytime telly so much. I love The One Show as well, things like that, because I love that one minute you can be talking about an advancement in cancer treatment, and then the next minute it's red squirrels. You know, I love the gear change on those TV programmes. I don't know if you've ever noticed that the gear change is quite astounding. So I was on This Morning on Good Friday, right, with my dog collar on. And it was lovely. Dermot and Josie were on, and I knew I was in safe hands. Dermot's a good Catholic boy, goes to Mass every week, so I knew I was in safe hands. Josie's, I don't know about her faith story, but you know, it was going to be fine. It's daytime TV. I was on after spring fashions, which blazers are in style this season. And before, a young man who was collecting Pokemon cards and had the world's biggest collection of Pokemon cards. And it's Good Friday, so they wheel the vicar out. So I'm sat there on daytime TV with my collar on, and this very question gets asked of, what is Good Friday all about? I've got 4 minutes on between blazers and Pokemon cards. So it's not really the time to sort of pick apart the idea of penal substitution theory. It's not really that moment, okay, on daytime TV. So I say, well, for Christians, Good Friday is good because it's the day that Jesus died, and you know that God shows us how much he loves us. But the good news is that Jesus didn't stay dead, that Good Friday, you know, was a tough day, but Easter Sunday is coming, and Jesus came back alive. Now, I thought that was a good, solid kind of Christian, even for people that don't have a faith. You know, the idea that the worst day of your life doesn't have to define you, and that good, and that Easter Sunday is coming. Even if you don't believe Jesus was the Son of God, that's a good message, right? That, you know, the worst day of your life doesn't have to define you. I got a lovely 8-page letter from somebody who thought I should have preached how everybody needs to be washed in the blood of the Lamb. That bit was in block capitals. Sin, I mean, we're all messed up people, right? I don't believe in a vengeful God. I believe in a loving God that loves me and you so much that I cannot conceive of an idea of eternal punishment. I also believe that I don't need to worry about it too much. I believe that I don't need to worry about what happens next too much. My job is to serve and to love my neighbour as I love myself, which means you have to love yourself as well, which is the tricky bit, right? And so I see sin all around, and I see sin in myself all the time as well. It's not a fashionable word, is it, sin? But I believe that my vocation began at the moment of my baptism when I was 3 months old. And that's when I stepped in and God went, I've got you. I've got you. And I believe that that's the case for all of us, baptized or not, that we are loved by the author of love itself, and that blows my mind. So no, I don't think God punishes. I don't think he thinks that we're naughty children who need telling off. I think he loves us like any parent does.
You'll be really.
I realise I used he pronouns there. I'm so sorry. I believe that God loves us.
You'll be relieved to know we're at the last question.
Are we?
Either. Well, we
write them down.
They've gone through. Can someone collect the question from this gentleman on the front row, and then we'll see. Well, so let me ask. So it's not the last question.
Oh, it's not
second but last question. Once this gentleman's question has been collected, is faith something that you just have? Just faith, full stop. Can you quantify it as having a little bit of faith? Is there a lot of faith? Is there I think it's a really quite clever question.
That's a clever question, because The book is called Have a Little Faith.
Yeah. Is there such a thing as a little faith?
Such a good question. I don't think quantity matters in this context. I actually don't think that faith is a quantifiable thing. You might have to help me out with this one. What do you think?
I think it's like an over the line, you know, you have faith, you don't have faith. It's not, I don't think there's a teeny weeny bit of faith and a massive amount of faith. I think, so faith for me is recognizing that God loves us. And one of the things that I like in the New Testament is it talks about, so believing in faith, same kind of idea, that you believe into Jesus. So it's not that you have this kind of, do you believe? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Yeah.
I believe 2, so I've only got a little bit. Actually, it's, do you believe in the person who loves you? Step over the line. So no, I don't think there is a such a thing as a little
faith. It's not like the I Spy books that you had when you were a kid.
Yeah.
You know the I Spy books that you had when you were a kid on a long journey where you had to see the things and tick it off? I don't think it's like that. I do think that... it is available to everybody. And I think faith looks like different things to different people as well. I don't think it's a one size fits all.
So now it's the last question from
yep.
the gentleman on the front row. Are your husband and children churchgoers?
Oh, this is a great question.
Yeah, it's a great question.
Great question. So yeah, I married the vicar's son. And yes, my children and my husband do go to church. My daughter at the moment is, she's just moved in with her boyfriend in Sheffield, which we really like him. But his family are atheists. So it's not just that he's not from a church family. Like, they don't do church at all. And his first meeting of, like, us was at Ruby and Arthur's confirmation. God love him. So he came along to
he
the cathedral.
He
was absolutely terrified, but he joined in and I watched him crossing himself like this, which was really fun. We had a lot of fun and he was really welcome. And he's really sort of like, no, this is important to you and your family. So I really want to support it and I really want to support Ruby. But she phoned me up the other day and I phoned her and she wasn't in. And I thought, where is she? And I phoned back. I said, where were you this morning? She went, Mum, it's Sunday. I was at church. And I did a little cry. Because you bring them up in the faith. I never expected it to stick. Do you know what I mean? I never expected it to stick. I hoped it would. But they find the faith themselves. And Arthur's an altar boy at our local church, which he loves. My son's autistic and our son's autistic. And it's great. They're really inclusive. And those are the best churches, right, where the family is together and it takes all sorts. And yeah, Graham's still a bit of a God botherer. So that's good, isn't it? Yes, so they do. The answer is yes, they do still all go to church.
Thank you for your question. Glad we got it in at the end.
Me too.
Kate, it's been an absolute joy talking to you, listening
Thanks,
to you
Paula.
This evening. Please, everybody, join me in thanking Kate for everything.
Thank you for coming. Us. I don't have a final thought. I think I'm done. And just finally, thank you to our book staff and thank you to our technical staff and to everybody who's worked here. And thank you to our signers as well. Thank you very much.
And a reminder to you that you can buy Kate's book over there. You can get it signed over there. Thank you so much for joining us. Do join us again for another event. Good night.
Oh, yes, you do lots of events, don't you? Yeah, you do. They do lots of these kind of things, so come.